For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hello.
So we've got another Hall of Fame class in the books, class of 2021. We've got some excellent inductees this year. Of course, kind of a strange year because the 2020 and 2021 classes were inducted so close together. But definitely some cool names here. And we're going to go back to an old format that we've done before, talking about these guys' last great games.
Yeah, this is a, you know, I love this format for shows, these last great games. We've gotten a lot out of these, and they're always kind of fun to explore and dig into. It gives us a chance to talk about some people that we don't usually talk about. It gets us a chance to kind of dig into the seasons and the careers of these people and stuff. So pretty cool stuff. But yeah, this is a very, very strange Hall of Fame class. I initially had this like weird thing in my brain where I was reading about the Hall of Fame class, and I'm thinking, man, I remember us doing shows, and I remember writing a column about the 2020 Hall of Fame class, and it does not feel that long ago. And then I had to realize, like, oh yeah, right, because it was like 3 months ago. So it's a very strange year with a lot of Hall of Famers coming in a short amount of time. But this is a, you know, this is a great 1-2 punch of Hall of Fame classes. Like it's also hitting me in like a very weird spot because like most of these men I saw like their entire primes, and now they're like old guys in suits getting like plaques, and I'm just like, oh man, I'm so old now. But it's starting to hit me lately a lot more than it had in any prior year, because it's like, oh, I remember all these guys' entire runs. Like, I remember Chris Bosh being drafted, so you know, I know the whole run of Chris Bosh. So it's a little bit to handle, but I'm enjoying it nonetheless.
Absolutely, yeah. So just we'll go through the whole class, and you know, and obviously we're going to focus on the guys who played in the NBA. First, the ninth winningest coach in NBA history, Rick Adelman, Chris Bosh, two-time champion and 11-time All-Star, Bob Dandridge, who's also a two-time NBA champ and a four-time All-Star, a very, very well-deserving, it's a long time coming for him, Tony Kukoc, who won three rings with the Bulls and was named one of FIBA's 50 greatest players, and Paul Pierce, who was a Finals MVP and a 10-time All-Star, Bill Russell, of course, was in the Hall of Fame as a player, now also in the Hall of Fame as the first Black NBA head coach, and won two titles as a coach. And Ben Wallace, a four-time Defensive Player of the Year and NBA champion. And Chris Webber, five-time All-Star, another guy who a lot of people thought should have been in earlier. And in terms of the others who did not play in the NBA, Villanova coach Jay Wright, Yolanda Griffith, who is a seven-time WNBA All-Star, two-time gold medalist, and Lauren Jackson, who's a three-time WNBA MVP, Val Ackerman, who's the first president of the WNBA, Con Fitzsimmons, who's a longtime NBA coach, headed five teams, including eight seasons with the Phoenix Suns, Howard Garfinkel, who ran
Howard Finkel.
Well. Howard Finkel.
No. Don't have ring announcer Howard Finkel? Unbelievable. Right. That's awesome. Yeah. Good for him. Yeah. Madison Square Garden. I get it. Madison Square Garden, sure. Knicks. I get it. Totally. Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Right. Yes. Howard Garfinkel ran the well-known five-star basketball camp from 1966-2008. Oh, yeah. You know, Howard Finkel would have been nice too. Clarence Fats Jenkins, a point guard and longtime captain for the New York Wren's barnstorming team in the 20s and 30s. And Pearl Moore, who was the all-time career scoring leader in women's college basketball and led the New York Stars to a WBL championship in 1980. We did a show way back in the Women's Professional Basketball League. That's some cool stories there. So that is the class, and we're going to dig into the guys who played in the NBA.
That's a really cool class. There's a lot of real cool guys there in terms of, like what you said, the guys that played in the NBA, Cotton Fitzsimmons, well overdue, as well as some kind of all-time great WNBA players as well, with Yolanda Griffith, right, and Lauren Jackson. I mean, Lauren Jackson, too, like an all-time great international women's basketball player, too, just like on another level. I earlier today was reading an article about her and didn't realize how much she accomplished. I mean, from pretty much from age 17 until I think she played until, God, at least into her late 30s. I forget exactly when it was. And it's just like, man, you look at the amount of things that she won and the amount of medals and championships and stuff. It's unbelievable how much she represented. So, yeah, real, real awesome for her as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to start with the guys who are in, of course, this year for coaching. Rick Adelman to start off with, obviously, you know, in for his coaching career, not for his playing career, but let's see what we can find. But first of all, a semi-fun fact, Rick Adelman never won Coach of the Year, which was definitely a big surprise to me.
Yeah, we were going through the coaches of the year in history and trying to find out how we can, you know, get Rick Adelman in there and find him, to, you know, a spot. And it's tough. Like he's a lot of the years that he's kind of having great runs, it's like there's also another guy out there having a tremendous run or whatever. There's a few years you can make a justification for, some of those Portland years in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you could probably make a justification for. It gets a little tougher as you get into the Sacramento Kings era. I think, you know, the one that we looked at that we were like, I don't know, is the 2000 year where Doc Rivers gets it for the Orlando Magic. They go 41-41. But then we did explore that year's Orlando Magic, their best player by a significant margin, was Daryl Armstrong. So
yeah,
that may have been a bad pick by the NBA to say, Doc, you somehow got a team led by Daryl Armstrong to 41-41. So we're going to give you this honor. But he seems like a good one. 2001, where Sacramento really explodes. At the same time, in the Eastern Conference, you have Larry Brown, you know, leading the 76ers all the way to the final. So it's like, ah, man, that's a tough one there. 2002, Rick Carlisle leads the Detroit Pistons to 50 wins.
That's probably the one. That's probably the one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking that's probably the one. Like, no offense to Rick Carlisle. It's a good year, good team. Yeah. But that might be the one where I go, okay, the Kings are like a bona fide like title contender this year. And the Pistons, I mean, they were very good this year as well. But yeah, that may have been the one that I said, ah, sorry, Rick, we're gonna. And I think we could do that now. I think retroactively we can go to Rick Carlisle's. He doesn't need it. Does he care? Does he care really about the 2002 Coach of the Year? The guy's got an NBA trophy, NBA ring. He doesn't care about that anymore.
That's true. Yeah, his only one though.
Yeah.
Only Coach of the Year. But yeah. Anyway, we'll try not to legislate the Coach of the Year. You know, too much anymore. I mean.
That'd be a great podcast. Rich and Jason go year by year, badmouth the man who won the Coach of the Year and decide who should have actually won it. So
I'm sure we could find some hot takes about that. Yeah,
honestly, that could work. Yeah. Yeah. George Carl, Denver Nuggets, get out of here. You know.
Yeah. Anyway, going back to Rick Adelman as a player, yes, he played for 7 seasons in the NBA. Played for the San Diego Rockets, the Blazers, and the Bulls, and then also would later play for the Jazz and the Kings toward the end of his career. So we're going to get into the point where he is still playing for the Bulls. This is November 3rd, 1974. 15 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists, and 4 steals playing for the Bulls in an 86-79 win over the Kansas City Omaha Kings. This is their final season in Omaha, so you know, definitely putting it all over the stat sheet there. And in this game, you've got, besides Rick Adelman, who had 1,042 coaching wins, you also have Jerry Sloan, who had 1,221, Mike D'Antoni, who has 672, and Matt Gukas, who is 230 himself. So a lot of a lot of featured coaches in this game. Good times. And is Adelman? He would his. Career averages would be 7.7 points per game, 3.5 assists per game. Definitely a role player throughout his career. He actually would only play 2 more games after this for the Bulls, and then he would be shipped to the expansion New Orleans Jazz for John Block. So he's going from Chicago to New Orleans, you know, maybe some ways an upgrade, you know, especially in the winter, you know, you get that better weather. But you know, he did not last a super long time in the Crescent City. After 28 games, he was traded again along with Ollie Johnson to the Kings. Of course, he had just had this, you know, really great game against the Kings. Like maybe the Kings remember that. Like, hey, let's bring Adelman back. We'll get him back. Yeah. And they traded him for Nate Williams. The Kings, they were playoff bound this year. This was going to be their first playoff appearance since 1967, back when they were in Cincinnati. And then, hey, their opponent in the playoff ends up being Rick Adelman's former team, the Chicago Bulls. So a lot of former teams here. Adelman only really plays a very small role in this playoff series. 5.7 minutes per game in the six-game series. The Bulls ended up advancing to the conference finals from the series. Actually, the other player in that trade, Ollie Johnson, actually has a bigger role for the Kings there. And then after the season, Adelman decides, hey, I'm going to retire. He works for a while as a shoe rep for Converse and then goes into coaching. He actually led the Chemeketa Community College in Oregon from 1977 to 1983. Then from there ends up becoming an assistant for the Trailblazers for several years until he takes the head coaching job in 1989. He'd end up coaching for three of the five teams he played for, the Blazers, the Kings, and the Rockets, of course, also coaching for the Warriors and Timberwolves in his Hall of Fame career. So fun times.
Yeah, and awesome. Just an all-time great coaching career. I mean, obviously it starts, you know, pretty great. You said like that first year in Portland, he takes over in 1989. It's 35 games. They're under 500. They're okay. And then just immediately out of the gate, it's 1990. They make it to the finals. You know, 1991, they win 63 games. 1992, they make it to the finals again. 1993, they're still good. And then things kind of go a little awry, and he is kind of floating around for a little bit. We'll talk about him in a little bit because there's going to be another player that him and this player are going to come together on a team with very low expectations to get them to some pretty awesome some heights as well. But I will admit I completely forgot about the Rick Adelman coaching the Minnesota Timberwolves era, but that did happen for quite a few years as well, pretty recently too. I just don't have any recollection of that time period, but it's after Sacramento it's a little bit of a blur, the Houston and Minnesota stuff. But yeah, I mean that run between Portland and Sacramento, brief stop in Golden State to have some losing in that hellhole of a franchise at the time, is, you know, that happened. But I mean a great run until, you know, the later parts of his career. But yeah, nothing to not be, you know, I mean, two Western Conference championships, almost another finals appearance with the Kings. I mean, yeah, it's a great run that he had.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So definitely will deserve one of the best coaches of his era. So despite lacking the coach of the year.
Exactly. The egregious lack of coach of the year that he received. So
yeah. Speaking of a lack of coach of the year, honors Bill Russell. He was, won two championships in his brief stint as player coach for three seasons with the Boston Celtics. Of course, at this point that we're going to be talking about, his final season in 1969, he has already won 10 rings with the Celtics in 12 seasons. That final year, he averaged 9.9 points per game and 19.3 rebounds per game. So he's 35 years old. He's still pulling down almost 20 rebounds per game. Still very productive, obviously not scoring as much anymore. But the Celtics at that point, you know, they're getting older. You know, a lot of their key guys are, you know, over 30. Finished fourth in the East that season. They're fending off these young upstarts. You've got the New York Knicks. You've got the Baltimore Bullets in the East. You know, Philly's still strong, even though they don't have Will Chamberlain anymore. And then the talk of the Western Division is the big three of Will Chamberlain, Jerry West, and Elgin Baylor. So, you know, despite finishing fourth in their division and having to, you know, be on the road for most of the playoffs, they are able to fend off all comers, you know, and they beat Philly in the first round. In the second round, they have a tough series against the Knicks, and this sets the stage for April 14th, 1969, Bill Russell, 25 points, 16 rebounds, 6 assists. This is game 5 of the Eastern Division Finals against the Knicks. And actually, funnily enough, the Knicks actually win this game, 112 to 104. The Celtics would be able to seal it up in game 6 by 1 point. Russell would have 12 points, 21 rebounds, and 5 assists in that game. But this this is the eighth to last game of Russell's career. This was his season high in points. He only had 20 plus points three times that season, twice in the playoffs. And during that season, he had 49 games of 20 plus rebounds, including 9 in the playoffs. So, you know, he's, you know, interestingly enough, almost every game in the playoffs, he's playing a full 48 minutes. You know, and you know, he's averaging, you know, it's a double, you know, 20 plus rebounds in 9 games of his 18 playoff runs. I'm looking here. I think he had at least 13 rebounds in that was his minimum of the 1969 playoffs. So, you know, he's definitely carrying his share as a player and as a coach as well. You know, he's scoring pretty good for the most part in the playoffs, especially in this Knicks series. The scoring kind of fades against the Lakers, but you know, obviously they are able to win that series in famously in seven games. You know, he's still, you know, not quite at the top of his game, but still obviously achieving a lot and able to lead his team to their 11th championship. And in fact, he was expected to play and coach the Celtics for one more year, but announced in the offseason as a surprise that he, in Sports Illustrated, that he was retiring. So, yeah, I mean, it is really good to see him in there for his accomplishments as a coach, you know, being the first black head coach in the NBA. And, you know, he had some good years as a coach later on in Seattle as well. You know, they didn't quite achieve, you know, they weren't a championship team or anything, but he definitely, you know, wasn't just a great coach because he was a great player. He also, you know, did achieve some, you know, good things as a coach. We won't talk about the Sacramento stop later.
Just leave that. It's Sacramento. I mean, come on. Nobody should be expected. The 1980s Sacramento Kings. Like, nobody should really be expected.
Unless you're Rick Adelman, you can't really expect to do much.
Right. You can't really expect to do much. But no, you're absolutely right. Like, I saw some people be like, oh, I don't know. You know, he's already in for a player. Does he need to be in as a coach? And it's like, he won two championships in the years he didn't win it. You know, the first year when he didn't win a title, he won 60 games as the coach. And yeah, it's the Celtics, and they were good. And he was playing at that time, so obviously he helped his coaching record. But hey, that should count for a little bit too. But no, even the Seattle run. I mean, yeah, he's in there for historic purposes, being the first black coach. But also, yeah, like the Seattle run, you know, he goes wins 43 games in consecutive years, wins 36 games, wins 40 games as well. So he's competent. And then yeah, obviously the Sacramento one comes, and I think everybody was kind of, I think he was probably just like, I'm kind of down here. This is boring. And like, he only lasts 1 year, 58 games. He's 53 years old. I think he's just kind of like, I'll do it. And then realizes, I don't want to do it anymore. This is stupid. This is dumb. I don't want this. So
no, but yeah. And I mean, just imagine the pressure he is as a, you know, as a player and a coach and as the, I mean, it was a big deal at the time. You know, when he was the first black head coach in the league. I mean, that was definitely something that was, covered him, and he was the natural choice, obviously, to replace, to replace Red Auerbach. There wasn't going to be an outsider who was going to work in that situation. Right. He was obviously the leader of the team, and you know, and did a really great job as a coach, and absolutely deserves the honor. So, Rich, I think we're going to talk a little bit more about our friends at Manscaped.
We are. So attention listeners across the galaxy, all the way from Australia, we mentioned Lauren Jackson earlier, to Houston, where Rick Adelman coached for a little bit, we have a pube problem. If so, our friends at Manscaped have cleared you for takeoff with their fourth generation and brand new Lawnmower 4.0. Kick your pubes to the next planet with the Performance Package 4.0. The orbits in your pants will feel like you're in zero gravity when you use the best tools for the job. From the leaders in male grooming, join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped and get your rocket ready for takeoff by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping with our code FANSIDED20. Again, it's 20% off plus free shipping, manscaped.com with that code FANSIDED20.
And if you're ready for an out-of-this-world experience, look no further than the Performance Package 4.0 from Manscaped that has taken off not only in the USA, but Canada, the UK, across Europe, Australia, South Africa, and Singapore. And even inside
Singapore, unbelievable.
Even Singapore, absolutely. And inside this package, you're going to find their Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer, the Weed Whacker ear and nose hair trimmer, the Crop Preserver ball deodorant, the Crop Reviver toner, performance boxer briefs, and a travel bag to hold your whole solar system.
Unbelievable. So first scheduled for liftoff here is the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer. This spaceship is here to guide you on a journey to trim your body, your balls, your butt, and even Uranus. This fourth generation trimmer also features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin safe technology. The Lawnmower 4.0 has a 7,000 RPM motor, a new multifunction on off switch that can engage a travel lock. And best of all, it is waterproof. It has a 4,000K LED spotlight that you can turn on and off when needed for a more precise shave throughout your travels across the universe.
And it also includes the Weed Whacker. It's like having a little astronaut to chop your worst weeds up top in your nose and your ear. The Weed Whacker is also waterproof and uses a 9,000 RPM motor-powered 360-degree rotary dual-blade system. This nose and ear air trimmer provides proprietary skin-safe technology, which helps prevent nicks, snags, and tugs in those delicate holes.
Oh, you gotta prevent those in those delicate holes. Absolutely. But do not, of course, forget the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant and their Crop Reviver to help your little planets be on their A-game while feeling the sun's heat. Manscaped even throws in two free gifts to that perfect package, the Manscaped Boxers, as well as the Shed Travel Bag. So again, get 20% off plus free shipping with the code fansided20 at manscaped.com. Again, that's 20% off plus free shipping with the code fansided20 at manscaped.com. Your dick and balls need some help for a clean Trinity and beyond. Your space balls will thank you.
And speaking of providing a legend some help, we got Tony Kukoc.
Tony Kukoc. Yeah, let's talk about Tony Kukoc coming into the Hall of Fame here. The best game that we're going to pick up from him is from April 9th, 2003. This is off the bench for the Milwaukee Bucks. Kukoc is now a member of the Milwaukee Bucks here. Scores 26 points, grabs 7 rebounds, dishes out 8 assists in a Bucks blowout of the Los Angeles Clippers. Of course, Kukoc, well known for his years as the Bulls, kind of sixth man or top scorer off the bench, but he's got a very interesting career even before that as well. So he grows up in Split, Croatia. He excels in his early days as a table tennis player, but then eventually realizes, wait a minute, I am 6'8". I should go do something else. And he moves over to basketball, which is a wise choice because he immediately makes a name for himself on the international stage. And the accolades are absolutely unbelievable for Tony Kukoc. Three-time EuroLeague champion, three-time EuroLeague Final Four MVP, 1991 FIBA EuroBasket MVP, FIBA World Championships MVP, multiple under-19s and under-18 MVPs, Croatian Sportsman of the Year three times as well, just numerous stuff. He is absolutely the man for Croatia in international basketball. For a while there. 1990, he is drafted by Jerry Krause. I should mention he's a part of that amazing Yugoslavian team as well, when obviously Yugoslavia was still together. But yeah, he's there with, you know, Drazen Petrovic and Vlade Divac and Tony Kukoc. And like, yeah, going back and watching some highlights from those teams, you're like, holy crap. Like, right, what a, that's why that team was like as good in many cases as the American team. Because like, look at them. They're amazing. Like, yeah, there's so many good players all at once. And it's pretty, it's unfortunate. Obviously, what happened with Yugoslavia, what happened with that entire team and a lot of those guys and you know, them ended up, you know, kind of not really getting along due to the Civil War going on and stuff. But yeah, you watch some of those games from like 88 or whatever, 88, 89, 90. Oh, yeah. It's like, wow, these guys are incredible. But Kukoc was drafted by Jerry Krause and the Chicago Bulls in 1990. A shrewd move by Jerry Krause at the time. And that's still when, you know, Europeans were icky and weird. And no, we don't want them. No. Like, they're not good at basketball. They just beat us, you know, in international play, but they can't handle the NBA.
They're not tough.
Yeah, they're just not tough. They don't know how to score. They shoot too much, like a bunch of pansies. We can't have that. They don't know what they're doing. Yes, yeah, did they just beat us a few years ago? Yes, they did.
And sometimes they pass too much.
Yeah, so they pass a lot, yeah.
Right, and they do pass a lot, yeah.
Stop. They run, and they pass, and they shoot, and that's just not going to work in the NBA. So.
Right,
But a shrewd move here by the Bulls, getting him in 1990. He would spend three more years in Europe before finally reporting to the Chicago Bulls. He would be joining a Bulls team that had just won three NBA titles. But unfortunately, he'd be joining a team that now was without Michael Jordan. But Kukoc was as good as advertised as well in 1994, despite, you know, some small hurdles adjusting to the game. The Croatian Sensation, one of my favorite all-time nicknames. He plays well, averages 10 points a game, primarily off the bench for the Bulls. But as later as the year goes on, I'd become a key piece of Phil Jackson's new-look Chicago Bulls, which that team would surprise the NBA world by really not missing that much of a beat in the wake of Jordan's retirement. Obviously, they would not win a title, but they'd finish 55-27. Scottie Pippen would assume a role as a top player. Kukoc would come in and kind of fill some of that scoring gap. And they make it all the way to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. I mean, they almost nearly beat the Knicks and go to the Eastern Conference finals. And now, I don't know, would they have, you know, would they have been able to make it through, you know, that year? I don't know exactly, but it's hard to say because they were a pretty damn good team, even without Michael Jordan. This is obviously when, you know, if you watch The Last Dance and or, you know, NBA history, you know, this happened, you know, this is during the infamous, you know, Pippen Kukoc tension where, you know, Phil Jackson calls a play for Tony Kukoc to hit a game-winning shot, which he does, and Scottie Pippen doesn't come off the bench and causes a lot of issues for a lot of people. And this, the resentment towards Kukoc was long-lasting as well. 1992, If you watch the Dream Team documentary or know any history about the Dream Team, that was a long time thing too, where Jordan and Pippen were very annoyed that Toni Kukoc was going to come to their team and be good for them, because Jerry Krause wanted to give Toni Kukoc money and he liked Toni Kukoc and yada yada.
And we're noting that, you know, Kukoc like did nothing wrong here. He was a proxy for, you know, a war between, you know, Pippen and Jordan and Jerry Krause.
Like, I just got signed me and I want to play basketball. They're like, fuck you, dude. Like, right. How dare you? Yeah. And the best part is, like, you know, in 1992, when that is going, like, you know, there is the tension and the civil war going on. I think it was in the Dream Team documentary. And they're like, oh, Tony, what'd you think about it? And he's like, I mean, I was like losing friends to a civil war. I didn't really care about, you know, like my family was being ripped apart by a civil war. And I don't really care. These guys are like, yeah, what's up, bro? What are you going to do, bro? And he's just like, I'm just going to play basketball and hope that my family lives during the civil war. So it just made it all so stupid, this the tension. But yeah, Tony Kukoc, there's nothing wrong here. Just wants to play basketball. But in 1995, Horace Grant departs the Bulls, joins the Orlando Magic. And that's when Kukoc will, you know, he'll come off the bench for a few games at the beginning of that year. And then he'll become a starter. And has a great season. He averages 15.7 points per game. Later in the year, Jordan returns. And Kukoc, who had been a, you know, key scorer for the team throughout the year, he does see his role reduced a little bit because it's Michael Jordan. And, you know, as much as I love Tony Kukoc, Tony Kukoc is a good player. But if you're Tony Kukoc, you know, a few of those shots per game could probably go to Michael Jordan. So you say, hey, here you go. Take some of these shots. I don't really need them that much. And then they would make a decent run through the Eastern Conference playoffs. They'd fall to Orlando. And then they'd come back, and you probably know the story. They'd win three straight titles. Kukoc would play a key role, mostly as a bench scorer, mostly as a sixth man. Does cap off the 1997 championship with a cool-as-hell dunk at the buzzer. And then the Bulls dismantle their team, and Kukoc is one of the last guys standing afterwards. When Pippen is gone and Rodman are gone and Jordan is gone, Kukoc is still there. He'd average a then-career-high 18.8 points per game on an absolutely dreadful Bulls team. Then after 24 games in 2000, he was mercifully sent to Philadelphia in a very, very bizarre, weird trade that ended up not working out for, I don't know if anybody, really. I guess Golden State maybe got the best. So it's a three-team trade. The Golden State Warriors trade John Starks and a 2000 first-round pick, eventually Chris Mim, to the Chicago Bulls. I guess, well, they traded Chris Mim for Jamal Crawford, so I guess that ended up working. So
yeah, there you go.
We'll go with that. John Starks did not work out for the Chicago Bulls, though, including he didn't want to play for the Bulls, so that didn't end up working out good. Bruce Bowen went to the Chicago Bulls, and they ended up not really using him either. He'd end up having a good career, obviously not with the Bulls. And the 76ers would trade Larry Hughes and Billy Owens to the Golden State Warriors. And This was attempt number seven, I think, to find a player that would work with Allen Iverson. It says Larry Hughes didn't work, and Tim Thomas had really worked, and Jerry Stackhouse didn't really work. They're like, all right, look, Tony Kukoc.
Yeah.
Jason, it did not work. February 22nd, he has moved to your Atlanta Hawks. They traded him with Nazi Muhammad, Theo Ratliff, and Pepe Sanchez. Go to the Atlanta Hawks. And that's for Rashawn McLeod. And Dikembe Mutombo. So they just said, all right, you know what? We're just going to get a guy who doesn't want to score. How about that?
Yeah.
Just this man doesn't want the ball. How about that, Allen? And guess what? That worked.
That worked, yeah. Everybody else just plays defense, and Iverson scores. And that worked pretty well.
You shoot every shot, and our other players are Aaron McKee and Dikembe Mutombo. Does that work for you finally? It did. Yeah. I was fine with that. A little over a year later, that is it for Tony Kukoc and your Atlanta Hawks. He makes his final stop. Milwaukee, the equally infamous, we talked about the Dikembe Mutombo trade, the equally infamous Glenn Robinson trade of August 2nd, 2002. We all remember where we were when this news came down that Tony Kukoc, Leon Smith, and a 2003 first-round pick would be sent to the Milwaukee Bucks for Glenn Robinson. And that leads us to 2003.
I do want to mention a fun fact. My first NBA jersey was a Atlanta Hawks Glenn Robinson jersey.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big old wings and stuff. Yeah, that's
It was a little bit too large for me,
it was a large jersey for Glenn Robinson at this time too. So. That worked out pretty well for both guys.
It was the era, exactly. So anyway,
For sure. But so this leads us to 2003, Kukoc's last great game here. As we said, a weird game and a very weird team as well. So the Bucks at this point are 2 years removed from making the Eastern Conference Finals against the Philadelphia 76ers, as we mentioned. But they're kind of in turmoil here. In February 2003, they trade what felt like their franchise cornerstone, Ray Allen, to the Seattle Supersonics for what felt like their franchise cornerstone, in Gary Payton, one of the weirdest trades of all time, just Ray Allen for Gary Payton. A few other guys moved along as well. And there were some financial implications as well, if you really want to get into the minutia of luxury tax and all that sort of stuff. But essentially it was both teams realizing, I don't know if these guys are going to lead us to anything, and we don't want to pay tax on them. So here you go. We'll just trade both of our parts here. But it does, in one way in Milwaukee, it does reunite Gary Payton with his longtime Supersonics coach, George Karl. And this new-looks Buck team is strange. The talent is there, but they're not great. It's Gary Payton. It's Sam Cassell. It's a very young Michael Redd kind of coming into his own here. Tim Thomas, the aforementioned Tim Thomas. Sort of Anthony Mason, kind of. Not really. He said it like sometimes Anthony Mason, not all the time Anthony Mason. Right. Joel Prisbilla, of course. One sure. of the key, obviously yeah. a key cog in that entire team. But on this night, the still pathetic but close to being okay Clippers come to town. And they get their doors blown off by the Bucks. 112-92. Kukoc comes off the bench, as usual, as he did during this time as well, but has what I would call the last great game of his career. 10 of 15 from the field, connects on all six of his free throws. He ends the game with 26 points, 8 assists, and 7 rebounds. Leads the team that night in points and assists. Tim Thomas narrowly edges him out with 10 rebounds, though. And this, unfortunately, would be Kukoc's last real productive year. The Bucks make the playoffs, and Kukoc averages 14.8 points per game in that postseason as well. The Bucks are going to fall to the New Jersey Nets in 6 games. And believe it or not, Kukoc would play on the Milwaukee Bucks until 2006, but his minutes and output drastically fall. And he was looking to hang on in 2007, but he didn't want to go too far, so he wanted to at least be in Milwaukee or Chicago. Neither team was interested, so that was the end for Tony Kukoc's career there. But I played a lot longer than I kind of remember him playing. I don't remember much of mid-2000s Milwaukee Bucks Tony Kukoc, but apparently it was a thing still.
No, I would not have expected that he played 254 games with the Bucks in his career. That would have been more than I would have expected. I kind of forgot. Yeah, I was kind of thinking it was probably done by like 04 or so. But yeah.
I really do not remember him at all on those, like, you know, the Terry Stotts, you know.
Right.
Like, led, you know, Andrew Bogut, Milwaukee Bucks teams. But apparently the Michael Redd emerging teams there. But apparently he did. So there you go.
Yeah, well, there you go indeed. So. Next, we have Chris Bosh. Bosh was the 4th overall pick in the heralded 2003 NBA draft. Of course, the one with, you know, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade, Darko Milicic, of course, you know, most famously Darko. He spent 7 seasons with the Raptors. He made 5 All-Star teams during that time. And then he joined the Heat along with LeBron James in the summer of 2010 to form the Heatles super team. They would make 4 straight finals and win 2 championships. He remained with the Heat even after LeBron returned to Cleveland in the summer of 2014. Overall, he spent 6 years with the Heat and was named to the All-Star team in all of them. And, you know, Bosh continued to play well in his new role. He missed the second half of the 2015 season because of a blood clot in one of his lungs, started to, you know, really see the health problems that would end his career then. He did return in 2016, though. The Heat bounced back. You know, they ended up finishing with a 48-34 record. They made the second round of the playoffs, took the Raptors to 7 games in that series. However, Bosh again missed time after the 2016 All-Star break because of a blood clot in his leg. Ended up having to sit out the rest of the season and the playoffs because of the medicals. He didn't really want to sit out, but the team insisted that he did. And, you know, after evaluation with the doctors, eventually did agree. He planned to return in the 2017 season, but he failed his physical, was eventually released by the Heat for salary cap reasons. He sought a return to the NBA in 2018, but in 2019, he announced he was officially done, and the Heat retired his number one jersey in March of 2019. So the game that we have to talk about is January 4th, 2016, 31 points, 11 rebounds, 1 steal, 1 block, 0 turnovers, only 8 for 20 from the floor. He was 2 of 6 for 3, but he was 13 for 16 from the line. This is a game against the Pacers. There's a AP recap of this game. The lead is Chris Bosh and Paul George had a quick conversation during one stoppage in play, both taking a moment to remember some of those epic Miami-Indiana playoff matchups a few years ago. I was joking with PG, just telling him how it was old times, Bosh said, and, you know, talking about just, you know, the fact that, of course, both the Pacers, they still had Paul George, but they were, you know, kind of fading. You know, the Heat obviously, you know, had moved, were post LeBron, and, you know, even though they were still playing well this season, definitely were in a new era, but it was kind of interesting to see. The Heat actually came back from 18 down to win this game against the Pacers. They won 103-100 in overtime. The game recap notes, it was the worst shooting game of the season for Miami, only shot 38% from the floor. And Eric Spoelstra's quotes here, and I don't know if this is the double meaning or not, if I'm taking something from it, but his quote was, "This was classic Eastern Conference basketball."
Shut up. What are you talking about?
So, like, is it because it's bad?
Yeah, because it was bad and low scoring and nobody had that much fun? Or, yeah, I don't know.
Or maybe, you know, I think thinking maybe perhaps defensive minded. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, yes, Ed Bosch ended up having an offensive rebound, made one of two free throws to seal the game in overtime. Paul George missed a game-winning attempt. I guess we can't make fun of Paul George anymore because he was really good in the last playoffs. So it's hard to, you know.
Yeah, no, he was tremendous. Yeah.
So, yeah. So we can't make fun of Paul George for failing in the clutch again, you know, because he did well. So we'll have to wait for another period of bad.
I'm sure it'll come. Yeah, I'm sure it will come. But yeah, I'm always amazed. I always figured that Chris Bosh was done a lot sooner. And I always forget that it's like, it wasn't that long ago. And it was, I always forget that he was, you know, he's still kind of there, even in the post LeBron.
Sure.
Run. Yeah, it's strange. I just I always thought it was like 2014 that it was over, or 2015 that it was over for him. But he ended up having a pretty, you know, long career all told, despite, you know, the medical issues, and felt like he still had a lot left in him. But obviously, you know, you'd rather be, you know, alive than you know, playing those last few years. So
more important. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he kind of had he was kind of the centerpiece of that team, you know, that first year back. I mean, Wade was still there, but Wade was definitely, you know, a bit diminished while Bosch was still, you know, closer to his prime and ended up kind of, you know, he was the guy whose numbers kind of took a hit when he joined the Heat, just because, you know, his role was more, you know, was more defensive, was more just kind of, you know, fitting in and, you know, filling the gaps. And, you know, he wasn't the guy anymore, but he kind of became the guy again and played really well up, you know, up until obviously the blood clot started to be an issue and he couldn't play. But he only had 19 games left in his career after this one. So very, very close to the end here. And, you know, he had some really good games after this. He was still, you know, a really effective player up until, you know, the very end. There was obviously he was, you know, only he was still relatively young. He wasn't, you know, he was 31, 32 years old. You know, he was still, you know, basically in his prime when he had to retire.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll move on here to Paul Pierce, a former rival in some ways of Chris Bosh here. I don't know if they ever stopped in the middle of the game and said, "Ah, man, Eastern Conference basketball ain't it great?" You know, maybe they did. I don't know.
Who knows? Yeah.
Maybe it was an 80-68 game, and they're like, "Oh, wow, this is what it is. This is the game." But anyway, we're gonna go to April 22nd, 2011, for what I consider his last great playoff performance. It comes in Game 3 against the Knicks. He scores 38 points on 14 of 19 shooting, including 6 of 8 from 3. We'll get to that game in a bit, but we'll talk about Pierce's career a little bit here. After a great college career from Paul Pierce, he's selected 10th overall by the Boston Celtics. And Pierce is pretty much a ready-made NBA scorer and pretty much an NBA star, like from jump, really. I mean, he averages 16.5 points per game his rookie year. And then little by little gets better. And then by his third year, he's up to 25.3 points per game. And he's, you know, leading a pretty good Boston Celtics team. But we should note that in 2001, September 25th, to be exact, he is stabbed 11 times in a nightclub. And you would kind of assume that might be it for, you know, his career or whatever. And he just goes on to play all 82 games that year. Just doesn't miss a beat. He just goes, that's all right. I nearly died, you know, a month ago, but I'll just play every single game. That's fine. And I remember I was listening to a quote from Rick Pitino, who was his coach at that time. It was in some article, and he was just like, we had to tell Paul, like, you know, stop taking, because he would like drive to the lane and take these big hits. And they're like, just maybe not, because you have like a lot of stitches. You were stabbed 11 times, sir. You might want to just, you know, take it a little bit easy. But he's like, Paul Pierce is just like, whatever, you know, I'll figure it out. And ended up being fine. Like, and there was almost no effect at all, which is pretty wild when you get stabbed 11 times and nearly die, that you just kind of kept on going on. So at this time, as we're saying after that 2001, and as the Celtics are kind of getting going here with Paul Pierce and Antoine Walker, Boston in the midst of a franchise crippling 6-year playoff drought. Jason, oh my God.
6 years.
If you think that Boston reacted to this the way that they did, they were insane during this time. Fucking Rick Pitino getting screaming at reporters, and it was madness. They missed the playoffs 6 straight years, Jason. Unacceptable.
Yeah. Nuts.
Just absolutely nuts. But luckily it didn't last that long. Pierce leads them back in 2002, his first year as an NBA All-Star. Him and Antoine Walker and a lot of other good role players lead the charge. The rejuvenated Celtics, they make a miracle run here. They blast through the Eastern Conference and eventually make it to the Eastern Conference Finals and lose in 6 games. They have a very, very close chance of making it to the NBA Finals, where they would inevitably get absolutely destroyed by the Lakers. But hey, they would have made the playoffs, so that would have been kind of cool. But it is Boston versus the Lakers in the finals, so I don't know. That would have been amazing if Antoine Walker, Paul Pierce, and the other ragtag bunch of the 2002, just because of the Boston thing, just end up beating the Lakers in the finals. But right. I don't know. That would have been a tough go. But Pierce would make the All-Star team the next 5 years. Celtics could never match that run, though, that they had in 2002. They'd lose in the first round the next 3 years, and they completely missed the playoffs in 2006 and 2007. And this would looked like it might have been the end of the line for Pierce in Boston. And this started to gain some steam actually this week. This report it came out, and a bunch of people chiming in on it as well. I don't remember ever hearing this before. I don't know if it was a rumor that a lot of people knew before, but it did gain a lot of steam this week as people were kind of recapping Paul Pierce's career. But in spring of 2007, Paul Pierce runs into Mavericks owner Mark Cuban in Las Vegas and tells him, "I'm your missing piece." Paul Pierce tells his agent to attempt to engineer a trade to Dallas. Quote, "I'm in my prime and I'm watching all these other guys in the playoffs. It was depressing. I thought I was out of there. I thought it was over." And Mark Cuban would then say on Twitter, when someone posted the story, says, "It gets better. We had a done deal. We had a 3-team trade done. All teams agreed to their part of the deal. When we get on the trade call, the third team killed the deal because they didn't know that a first round was going to the Celtics. So they chose not to do the deal at all." So it falls through. It doesn't happen. And then Danny Ainge goes to his backup plan, which was acquiring Kevin Garnett from Minnesota. Totally, totally not a favor from Ainge's former Celtics teammate, Kevin McHale. Just a very normal, fair trade between two former friends and still friends. But ended up working. And then he gets Ray Allen, the aforementioned. We talked about Ray Allen earlier. Gets him to Boston as well. So the Celtics have a big three. And predictably, the big three was great. They win an NBA title their first year, and they contend for pretty much the entire run of those three guys. They'd win the title in 2008, as we said. In 2009, they lose to the upstart Magic in the Eastern Conference semifinals. 2010, they'd make it back to the finals, where they'd lose to the Lakers. And then the 2011 Celtics, which we're talking about here, looked to get back and redeem themselves. They'd start, obviously, with a first-round series sweep against the Knicks, led by this game three that we're talking about here. Pierce is on fire. He scores 38 points, 14 and 19 shooting, 6 of 8 from 3, a perfect 4 from 4 from the free throw line. Rondo in this game dishes out, I think it's 21 assists. I wrote 12 here, but I'm pretty sure it's more than that. Let me double check, make sure I get it right, because it's more than 12, because 12 is not that impressive. 20. It was 20 assists. That's more. But he had 11 rebounds, too. Rajon Rondo. Remember when he was amazing and great and really, really good? And Garnett, he gets 12 rebounds, and they cruise to the win, eventually put away the Knicks, who I did not realize. So this Knicks team, obviously, after years of struggling, this is the Mike D'Antoni, I believe his first year? No, third year. Third year in New York.
Right, because he had some bad teams to start.
Yes, he had some real bad teams. And Jason, I'm going to this team is they make the playoffs, but I would say that this is a bad team, because here's the starting lineup for your Knicks.
My Knicks.
Your beloved Knicks.
My beloved New York Knicks. Okay.
Carmelo Anthony. Okay. Sure. Good player. Yeah. Amari Stoudemire. Great player.
Right.
Tony Douglas.
Well,
Landry Fields.
Right.
And Ronnie Turioff.
Yeah.
Yikes. He got I hope he won Coach of the Year in 2011 to get this team to 42 wins. But they would sweep.
You got Jared Jeffries on the bench too.
Yeah, it's a murderer's row of guys that are players in the NBA for sure. Yeah.
Man, they had Chuck Williams on that deep bench and they didn't play him. Really? Yeah.
I think the corpse of Chauncey Billups is on that team at one point too.
He didn't play in this game.
I think he was maybe on the next team.
Yeah, he was around during that time. I can't remember exactly. But this is the year before Lintanity, right?
Correct. This is during the year when they do trade for Carmelo Anthony, and they basically gave the Nuggets all of their bench and all of their starters.
Okay.
We don't need any of these guys anymore because we have Carmelo Anthony. It's like, all right, I mean, well, you know,
right?
You sure that's you don't right. want Kalinari and Raymond Felton and Wilson Chandler and a bunch of these picks? Like, no, we don't need any of those. Take all. Anthony Randolph, you don't need him either. No, okay, all right, yeah, fine. We'll just take everybody then. That's fine. So that leads you with the Tony Douglas, Landry Fields, Ronnie Turiaf starting five there. But anyway, Boston would eventually lose in the Eastern Conference semifinals against a new big three, the Miami Heat. Chris Bosh, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, as we just talked about here. Boston would have one more gulp of contendership in 2012. They make it to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals before once again falling to that Miami Heat team. And then by 2013, it all comes crashing down. They'd still make the playoffs, but that was it for the big three, as Ray Allen had left the team earlier to join Miami, and everybody would get all mad at him still to this day, I think. I forget if they've actually gotten over that, if they're still upset about it. But Pierce... I would move on to Brooklyn in 2014. Then he'd have his little run with Washington as well, kind of a miracle fun run. I enjoyed the Pierce Wizards run where he was like not that great, but still kind of okay run in 2015.
He had a game winner in that playoffs against the Hawks, and he had one really good game there as well. And then almost hit the game winner, but it came after the shot clock or after the game clock. It was like they had to review it and it didn't come in time. So otherwise, he would have hit two game winners in that series.
Yeah,
so.
That was a fun run there, though. John Wall at his prime and Bradley Beal kind of coming together, and Paul Pierce being the veteran leader and stuff. It was fun.
It wasn't fun for me, but objectively, I could see where you would say it was fun.
An objective viewer found it pretty interesting. But then he would end his career on the Los Angeles Clippers in 2016 and 2017, but never quite recreated that magic that he had in obviously in Boston, and then that fun run he had in Washington in 2015.
Yeah. Yes. So, next we have, speaking of Washington, Bob Dandridge, who was a four-time All-Star for the Bucks and later the Bullets. And he actually, I found this out today, he actually scored more points in the NBA Finals than any other player in the 1970s. He had four appearances and scored more points than any other NBA player did in the Finals during that decade. So kind of a fun fact there.
Yeah, take that Wilt. Take that or take that Kareem. What do you?
Right, take that Kareem. Yes. In fact,
Bob Lanier, get out of here.
I would say, yeah.
You bum.
Bob Lanier not making a lot of finals in the 70s. No, not
no,
that,
no.
Not
no.
So much, no. He was the perfect complement, I would say, to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Oscar Robertson on the Bucks. They won the 1971 title, and they made the 1974 finals, losing in seven to the Celtics. And he was definitely one of the first major NBA free agents to switch team, helping put the Bullets over the top to win the 1978 title and make the 1979 finals. He retired with averages of 18.5 points per game, 6.8 rebounds per game, 3.4 rebounds per game, 16.7 PER. I only mentioned PER because I always thought it's interesting. By comparison, James Worthy finished with relatively similar stats in his career. Slightly less points per game, slightly less rebounds per game, right around the same assists per game, and a little bit of a higher PER. But not that PER is perfect, but given their career spans, the best number to use as a one number comparison. One of them, of course, was on the NBA's top 50 list, made the Hall of Fame 9 years after he retired. It probably had nothing to do with it, but he happened to play for the Lakers, you know, and, the other made it to the Hall of Fame finally 39 years after he retired. So, I don't know why, but hey, he's finally in. So that's good times.
Yeah. Long overdue. And we've been, I think, screaming about this as long as the show's been around. He's one of the guys that absolutely belonged in this Hall of Fame. And yeah, it's unfortunate it took this long, but at least he's finally there. And at least we finally got it done. So I guess we didn't get it done, but maybe. I mean, I
advocated for it, you know. So
yeah. We said something, it happened, thus we played a part in it. So I'm gonna go with it.
I'm gonna give us the full credit, 100% credit.
Full. All right. Hey, you know what? Go off. Yeah,
let's do it. Why not? Yeah. Anyway, last great game, we are picking January 27th, 1980. He had 27 points on 6-22 true shooting, 9 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 blocks, a 22.6 game score in a 116-107 win over the Warriors. He was 32 at this point. His season, in fact, would be over after only 7 more games this season. He'd only play 34 more career games after that. He returned to the Bucks briefly in 1982. And they'd already had a frustrating season in 1980. You know, of course, they made the finals in 79, won the championship in 78. They were expecting to contend again, you know, even though they, you know, their top stars, you know, Hayes, Unseld, and Dandridge were all getting older. But as we discussed, I believe in our last show, you know, they were getting Kevin Porter in. You know, they were going to fast break. They were going to, you know, be exciting again. Dick Motta was super excited about how great they were going to be. But unfortunately, didn't go well. Part of it was Dandridge, you know, he had more injury struggles than he'd ever had previously in his career. And the team was definitely frustrated with him in and out of the lineup. There's an article from the Washington Post in February 1980. And Dick Motta is very candid. He says, "We can't win without Bobby, and everybody knows it." And there's one anonymous player who says, "I don't know if Bobby is really hurt that bad or not, but all this stuff he's pulling is hurting us. I'm glad they sent him home." So
yikes.
Yeah. And then Dandridge says, "Yeah, I wasn't completely healed when I joined the team in Denver, but I want to try to play at help. The doctor told me to try it, but if it hurt to stop playing," and that's basically just what happened. And then another Dick Motta quote, "I have to believe he's hurt when he says he's hurt." That's all there is to it. It's demoralizing when it happens, but there's nothing anyone can do about it. I do know that it's starting to have a bad effect on this team, though, which I feel like if you say, "I have to believe he's hurt when he says he's hurt," that means you don't really believe it.
Yeah, no, that's just the way to say I don't believe it. But yeah, I mean, yes, I'm legally
yes,
and public PR wise obligated to say I believe him, but I totally do not believe him. So.
Right. So Dandridge's injuries were that season: a sprained ankle, a strained ligament in his foot, a stiff neck, a sore back, a groin muscle pull, and now and then a pulled calf muscle. So, you know, obviously there's another quote in here where he talks about how, like, if they were fast breaking more, he thinks he would actually be healthier, but because they're playing so slow, he has to be like in the post more and take like a bigger pounding. And, you know, that's not helping either. So I found that interesting considering the idea of them being a big fast breaking team with getting Kevin Porter in. But anyway, the Bullets at this point, they would finish 39-43. Dick Motta would leave to join the expansion Mavericks. The Hayes-Unseld combination would be done after another year, and Dandridge would leave as well, and the Bullets would basically be a mediocre to bad franchise for the next, 30 to 40 years, I guess. So that's pretty much it.
Well, and I guess this is a good segue into this guy who did not help them not become a bad franchise either, Chris Webber.
Yeah.
I guess he got into one playoff, so we'll take that.
But, yeah, right.
Yeah, Chris Webber, he's in the Hall of Fame now. We're going to go to January 5th, 2001 for his what I consider his last truly, truly great game.
Okay.
And this stinks because obviously he had many, many years after this, and he has a lot of very good games. But this one is like amazing. I mean, this is like, when we talk about great, I mean, this is like one of his greatest games ever, and I just felt it was a good time to talk about that one versus, like, you know, some pathetic, weird, you know, 76ers game where he scores 22 points. You know what I mean? That's not very fun. Let's talk about the good times with Chris Webber,
right?
Not the Chris Webber that couldn't jump, you know, shooting a bunch of 19 footers and you know, 5 of them go in, and that's a good game. But this game, 51 points, 26 rebounds, 24 of 47 from the field. A pathetic 3 of 6 in the free throw line, though. Come on, get your game together, man. Let's go. Come on.
Yeah.
But which actually, man, it cost them this game. We'll talk about it in a bit. But a little bit of a Jalen Rose revenge game here for Chris Webber against his former Fab Five member here. Surprisingly, Webber's one and only 50-point game. So we probably touched on it when we did a series about guys that surprising, you know, not 50 games, like guys that we thought would get more 50-point games that never did. I forget if we brought Chris Webber up in that, but this is it. This is his one and only 50-point game. And what's weird is he's not even, like, close that often. He has 4 40-point games, 4 of which are 41 points, and 1 is 40. So it's not like he's getting 48 and 47. Yeah. Like, he's never close to that. And it's probably the area he's playing in. It's the teams he's playing on. But still, you kind of assume that Chris Webber, you know, especially during the time when he was just an all-time great, that, he would have gotten some more 50-point games, but he never really did. So,
I don't think of him as like a, I mean, he was a great player, but I don't think of him as like absolutely great scorer. I mean, he could score, but he was more I, you know, a little bit more along the lines of somebody like Garnett or Duncan, where he did everything well, but he wasn't necessarily going to be, you know, putting up a lot of shots, at least not, you know, routinely. He would do it once in a while. So.
Yeah. And his best game was probably when he, you know, he was drawing double teams, then passing out to Peja or, you know, dunking it to Bibby cutting the lane or whatever. I mean, those are, and that's when the Kings really hum. So there was probably a lot of times where they didn't want him to just go out there. He probably could have. But, you know, it's like, no, we don't need you to go do that. We're much better off.
Better if you're not. Yeah,
scoring 35 and then dishing out, you know, 8 assists. It's going to work out a lot better for us. So I did want to note this here. Playoff career high was 34 in game 1 of the 2001 Western semis against the Lakers as well. So it's not like in the playoffs he had a bunch of huge scoring explosions either. Yeah. But at this time, Weber is 3 years into his run with the Sacramento Kings, a run that was seen by Weber himself and many in the NBA as a failed superstar being cast off to Cowtown. He's drafted first overall in 1993, spends only 1 year with the Golden State Warriors, uses a one-year escape clause to leave the team. He would then move on to the Washington Bullets to reunite with his former college teammate, Juwan Howard. And the results, as you mentioned there, by, you know, the team not being very good ever, is they were mixed. He played well. He made the All-Star team in 1997. Finally, though, in 1998, he does lead the Bullets / Wizards to their first playoff series in 9 years. Unfortunately, they face off with the 1998 Chicago Bulls. And I don't want to spoil the last dance for you, but it does not go very well for Weber and the Wizards. It's I think, mentioned for about 25 seconds in that entire series. That lets you know how that goes. Yep. In May of 1998, Weber is on the move again. He's being traded to the Sacramento Kings for Mitch Richmond and Otis Thorpe. And at this time, Sacramento, one of the starriest franchises in the NBA at this point, despite having a pretty loyal home following. The franchise had made only the playoffs only twice in the 13 years they'd been in Sacramento. And no offense to the fine folks of Sacramento, but it's Sacramento. It's not exactly the sexiest NBA team as well. So nobody really wanted to go there. They weren't really successful. It was kind of a weird. It's one of those like, man, why did they have a team in Sacramento type things? And not to say that I still question that today, but I still sometimes I'm like, yeah, man, really? Sacramento? It's a weird place for a team. But all right, they have a loyal fan base, so good for them. And I like Sacramento. I've been there, but it's like, yeah, you go and you're like, oh, this doesn't seem like an NBA town. But hey, you know what? Yeah. It's worked out for them. But there was many pieces this week about this deal, and Weber was vocal about this at the time as well. But, you know, he said he thought he was going to be traded to a California team. Fortunately, he thinks he's going to the Lakers. And he thinks he's getting traded for Eldon Campbell, Eddie Jones, and Nick Van Exel, which is a much bigger package than Mitch Richmond and Otis Thorpe, we should say. That's a pretty damn good deal if that happened. Yeah. But instead, it was Sacramento that he was traded to. Weber says they wanted to banish me to Sacramento. That's what that was. But what ended up happening is kind of a storybook scenario here, where Weber eventually gets to practice. Rick Adelman's there. He's the coach. He's a veteran coach. You know, Vlade Divac's there. There's enough veteran guys to say, hey, look, you know, we got a good team here. So if you're willing to buy in, I think we could do some good stuff. And they do. Weber embraces the small town and becomes really the NBA superstar so many people thought he could have been during those years. He makes 4 All-Star teams in a row, leads the Kings to unprecedented success, including taking the Lakers to the absolute brink in 2002, going, you know, minutes, seconds, points away from making the NBA Finals in 2002. Unfortunately, though, injuries and eventual unrest leads Weber to leave the town for Philadelphia, Detroit, and then finally he does 9 games with his original franchise, the Warriors. But that 2001 game that we're talking about here, you know, how does Weber do this? How does he explode for a career-high 51? And he just kind of does. Peja Stojaković, who had at this time established himself as a solid number 2 for the Kings, averaging 20 points a game, 20-plus points per game. He shoots really poorly. He's 3 of 10 from the field. Jason Williams, Weber's flashy point guard, who at this time helped me and I'm sure many, many other people learn how to download videos on the internet. So we go watch Jason Williams highlight videos. We got many viruses along the way, but we got some pretty cool highlight packages with that as well. He was 4-15, which unfortunately was a pretty familiar sight for Jason Williams. And Doug Christie was another good scorer on the team. He goes 0-4, so they just kind of go, all right, well, no one else is scoring, so Weber, it's up to you, man. And, you know, he had led the team in scoring that year at 27.1 points per game, and he just kind of decided, well, I'm just going to do everything this game, and he does. He scored 51 of Sacramento's 91 points. He scores. I was able to find a highlight from this, and he pretty much just bullies Jermaine O'Neal, who's very young at this point. I think Jermaine O'Neal's still like 20 or 21 years old at this point, still pretty skinny. It does not go very well. So Weber's first shot of the game, he goes up for a post shot, and Jermaine O'Neal just swats it away, and Jermaine O'Neal kind of talks some shit after it. And Weber clearly is just like, all right, now you have to die. Like, and then the next 47 minutes is just an assault on Jermaine O'Neal, and unfortunately, Sam Perkins, our guy Sam Perkins, does not do well in this game either. He gets just destroyed by Chris Weber. Dunks, putbacks, head fakes, fadeaways, just rebounds galore from Chris Weber. Eventually, Chris Webber does get to 51 points, no three-pointers, only 6 free throw attempts during that as well. Fab 5 teammate Jalen Rose, 19 points and 7 of 18 shooting as well. And weirdly enough, though, the Kings would lose this game in overtime as Weber missed all 5 of his shots in overtime. Only John Barry. Do you want to talk about Eastern Conference basketball? The Pacers bring Eastern Conference basketball to Sacramento here. Only John Barry would score in the overtime period for the Kings. He would score 2 points. Jalen Rose, he provided 4 points for the Pacers in the overtime period. So real exciting stuff here from these guys. The Kings are going to fall in this this game. They're going to fall to 21-9. The Pacers improved to 15-19. The Kings would end the season 55-27, make it all the way to the Western Conference semifinals against the Lakers. The Pacers, they would finish 41-41 and lose in the first round to Allen Iverson and the 76ers. So, as I said, there's probably some, you know, a random Philadelphia game there that you could probably pick out for Chris Webber. But I thought when we talk about truly great games, this is one that stood out to me just to show you, you know, how great he could be when he really just was out there saying, hey, I'm going to have a great game. But yeah, again, there's some pretty good Philadelphia games and stuff like that. But it kind of falls off a cliff in those later years, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And worth noting that Chris Webber's 47 field goal attempts were the most since Michael Jordan had 49 in 1993. So he's on the, you know, if you look at like after 1978, there have only been 11 times where somebody has attempted more than 44 field goals in the you know, in a game. So he's definitely an exclusive company for doing that. So good for him.
Yeah, get some shots up. He's probably, yeah, probably sore, right, the next day, but hey, go hey, for it.
Right. Yes. And Kobe Bryant has had 6 of those games.
Oh, Jesus.
Yes. Including dropping, of course, the 50 in his 60-point game. So,
yes. Yeah.
Yes. So good times. So next we have our final selection is Ben Wallace. So I like how you you and I have different approach to this. Like, I tend to pick a game that's kind of close to the end of their career where you're like, oh, I don't want the mediocre game. I want like the
the greats. You know, I want great. Great, yeah.
Game. I want the great game. Yeah.
Yeah. It's we've switched off in these great game series. Yeah. It depends who you talk about, but someone like a Chris, I'm so depressed by Philadelphia, Chris Webber, right, that I just don't want to, like, he's got a headband and he's kind of fat and he can't really jump. And it's just, it's so
I get
sad.
It. Yeah. No, I like that we do it differently. I think it's fun, but this one, which is
you better, you better not have chosen a Chicago Bulls Ben Wallace game, because I do not identify with that. Okay, good.
All right. Well, the funny thing is, this is kind of both. This is so it's December 11th, 2010, one day before my daughter's 2nd birthday, and this is Ben Wallace's career high in points, which you know, not that Ben Wallace was ever a big scorer, but you would not have expected that Ben Wallace would have, you know, I would not have expected that Ben Wallace would have had his career high in points, you know, in like one of his last 2 seasons.
Right. You would assume like one of those years and when the Pistons are just cruising that they just like have a joke and they're like, hey, Ben, score 30. And he's like, no, I don't really want to. They're like, no, we were fine. Like, we're winning. Because that would have been hilarious if those guys just like, because they could play around for a few of those years. They were so good. You know, they were dominating the Eastern Conference. That would have been fun where they just have a game where they just feed Ben Wallace all game. Right. It's like, stop. It's like, yeah. I don't want to. I'm not that good at scoring. Like, yeah. Come on. Yeah. You got it.
It's
you
know. Gonna be fine. Yeah. Right. So 23 points on 779 true shooting. 1 of 1 from the 3-point line.
I got to see it. So is this like a heave or like did he actually spot up and just fucking drain it?
We'll talk about it. Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait.
14 rebounds, 4 assists, 5 steals, 4 turnovers. This is his career high in points for the regular season. He did have 29 points in the playoffs in 2005 against Philly. Unfortunately for him, the game did not go as well for his team. The Pistons ended up blowing a 25-point lead in the second half, and the Raptors won 120-116. So
maybe that's why you don't feed Ben Wallace the ball.
Right. Well, yeah. So he ended the game with a 3-pointer at the buzzer. I did not see if it was a heave or what the circumstances were, but this was the 5th 3-pointer of his career. He finished his career 6 for 42 from 3. So he took 42 threes in his career, but which is more than I kind of would have expected. But, you know, obviously you occasionally get those situations at the end of the shot clock or whatever where you might take one. But Tayshaun Prince quote saying, hey, you look at the box score. We've got guys setting career and season highs all over the place. But the other team shot 63% and won the game. We just self-destructed. I don't know how else to explain this. So not great vibes in Detroit. We'll get more into that. But this is early in the second season of Wallace's second stint in Detroit. He previously won four Defensive Player of the Year awards, helped lead the Pistons to the 2004 NBA title. He'd call it a career after one more season. He'd finish with averages of 5.7 points per game, 9.6 rebounds, and 2.0 blocks per game, which is 25th all-time. He is fifth all-time in defensive box plus-minus. In addition to the Pistons, he also played for the Bullets Wizards franchise, 1 year with the Bullets, 2 years with the Wizards, the Magic, and the Bulls, and as you mentioned, and the Cavs. So, and you look at this Pistons team, yeah, kind of a sad crew because you've still got Tayshaun Prince and Rip Hamilton. They had never left at the time. Rip Hamilton was soon going to be on his way out. Prince would be there for a couple more years before he would be gone as well. You got Rodney Stuckey and Greg Monroe, and they're like the young players who at one point kind of seemed like they might be something and then ended up not really reaching their potential. And then you've got Charlie Villanueva and Ben Gordon, who were like the big free agents that the Pistons signed. It both looked like they actually might be okay fits for the team, but they both just really went south right away. And the team got mediocre to bad pretty quickly. And then you got Tracy McGrady, who's on his last legs, in there. And then their coach was John Kester, and I kind of forgot about this, but there was a whole thing. He only lasted 1 year as the Pistons coach, never coached again in the NBA. The team actually formed a mutiny against him. Five of the key players missed shoot around the morning before that night's game. Team sources told multiple media outlets that the players were staging a protest. And, there were sources told the Detroit media that the shoot around boycott was directed at John Kester. Actually, he was in his second year as their coach, who had clashed with players in the past. He ended up being fired after after that season. The Pistons finished 30-32 that year. And I kind of thought this was like near the end of the Joe Dumars era, but he actually hung on for like three more years after that. So, in 2014. So yeah, just a, definitely a personally great game for, Wallace. And I think nice for the fans to see him back. And he actually like played still pretty well. I think through the season, still did the stuff that he was good at and still was, helpful toward winning, even if his numbers were never impressive. Obviously he averaged 5.7 points per game. So that wasn't what he was about, but this is kind of the very end of this era of Pistons basketball.
Yeah, I was liking, Ben Wallace's late career to sort of what we got with Dennis Rodman, where like a little by little, he just became like ultra one-dimensional. Like there was times where he could do both things. There was times where, then by the end, it's just like, you know what you're getting out of Ben Wallace. Like you don't even want him to touch the ball. You just kind of want him to get some rebounds and throw some blocks or whatever. And it's never quite as good as it was, but it's still fine. Like he was still a relatively productive player into those final few years. The Cleveland years, of course, he was still pretty damn good and those last few Detroit years. But the problem was he just like completely stopped scoring or even attempting to score or kind of became a little too one-dimensional, but it's still, you knew exactly what you were getting out of the guy and it was fine. You know what I mean? It was perfectly,
sure,
perfectly fine. This is also the year where he met me in an elevator as well.
So, oh yeah.
As opposed to the other way around. Yeah. I did not meet him. He met me in the elevator.
He met me. I bet he was probably pretty intimidated by how.
Oh, he was certainly intimidated.
I can see that. Yeah. Right. Yeah,
he's a tall man. I'll just sell that. Yeah. Even though he's not tall in NBA speak.
Right. Right.
He's a very, very tall man. So,
for an NBA center, he's not particularly tall. But
no, he was not.
But compared. Yeah.
The girl I was dating at the time said, why didn't you say anything? And I was like, what am I going to say to Ben Wallace? Hey, Ben. And this is like coming off like the Chicago Bulls years where I was not that big of a fan of Mr.
Right.
Ben Wallace. So
yeah.
In retrospect, Ben Wallace was actually on the right side of the history with that. But,
oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
But at the time, I was an idiot and was like,
you're
no.
blinded. Yeah.
Trying to wear the headband. Scott Skiles' rule, man.
Follow Scott Skiles' rule,
In retrospect, Ben should have worn the damn headband and thrown a towel at Scott Skiles' face, similar to Robert Horry, but he didn't.
Exactly, yeah.
Not do that. Ben Wallace, right. He rules, though. I love Ben Wallace. I'm glad. Yeah, it's just awesome. I mean, a guy from Virginia Union, a guy that, wasn't really, like, you're like, yeah, how is this guy as good as he was? Like, he ended up having just a tremendous career. Just one of the great NBA stories of all time. Bounces around a bunch. He's on the Bullets. He's on the Wizards. He's on the Magic. And it's just like, yeah, what does this guy do? What happens? He goes to Detroit, and it's like, oh, he just doesn't score. He just shoots. But then he did kind of score a little bit, and they were good, and then they won titles. Yeah. And they were that was a really, really fun team for a while. He was probably – I mean, Rasheed Wallace is obviously the most fun member of those Pistons teams, but I put Big Ben right up there. I mean, he is just a fun, fun player.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, good time. So, yeah, we've gotten through another show. This has been a fun one. Always interesting to just kind of, like, you know, find one game to hone in on and, you know, find some stories there. Yeah. It's always a good deal. So, so thanks, Rich, for another fun time.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
All right. And thanks, everyone, of course, for checking us out. You can find us at thestepback@fansided.com. Lots of great NBA content there as the season gears up. And, you know, if you're interested in what we're doing, give us a rating and review on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. We always appreciate that. Always helps other people find the show and it makes us feel good about ourselves, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we need the most. Yeah.
And speaking of instant gratification, if you want to, you know, follow us on social media, we are on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. We haven't really ventured out into any more modern social media because I don't know if just, you know, I'm old, you're getting old. I don't know if that's for us.
I don't understand that. I've gotten to the point where I almost barely understand the new ones. So, yeah, that's
right. So, but if you really, really want us on a new social media platform, we'll think about it, I guess. So you can beg at us again on Facebook or Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back again soon.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.